On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's a conundrum. Oil prices are sky high. The country's locked in a tar pit war. Real estate's gone soft. Wages are actually going down. And the U.S. economy is on a tear. Sizzling, roaring, surging. You know all the headline words. First quarter growth in GDP was up 4.8%, the highest rate in 2.5 years. Business spending up 14.3%. Consumer durables, all those new fridges and motorboats, up 20.6%. Economists don't know how long it can last, and Americans say the country is headed in the wrong direction. But there's that economy. Up next on Point, Yale's Robert Shiller and the Wharton School's Jeremy Siegel on the pumping U.S. economy. Joining me first today from Washington for the latest numbers is Greg Ipp, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Greg, it's been a while. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, Tom. It's nice to be back.
So you've been cooking up something big here while we've been away. Walk us through the numbers that have got all these headlines roaring, surging, sparkling, leaping in the papers this week.
Well, Tom, as you said, the main event was the first quarter growth number. Real GDP expanded at a 4.8% annual rate. That's robust by any measurement. And the last few monthly numbers have also been impressive. We had job growth of 211,000 in the month of March. We had relatively firm housing sales despite many predictions of a collapse. And the business capital spending numbers look good. And to top it off, this week we've got the Dow Jones Industrial Average hitting a 6-year high. So there's definitely a lot of good things, good feelings around. But let's step back for a second, shall we?
Yes.
One of the reasons the first quarter was so strong was because the fourth quarter was so weak for various, like, temporary reasons, things like some car sales, oil production because of Hurricane Katrina, and defense spending because of the way Washington works. Those were all unusually low in the fourth quarter, and so you had a bounce back in the first quarter. That won't be repeated. And so it seems more likely that growth in coming quarters will be much more modest, probably in the 3% range. And also, let's think about what some of the so-called forward-looking indicators are telling us. Interest rates have been rising for about 2 years now, more so at the short term than at the long term.
Right.
And we know that interest rates tend to work with a lag. Also, although housing sales tend to be fairly strong, housing prices are not going up as much. And as a result, people will be able to borrow less against their home equity to spend on other things. And finally, as almost everybody knows, gasoline prices are very high. And even though that's not likely to lead to a collapse in consumer confidence, it will definitely eat into people's after-inflation pay. And that will probably exercise some restraint on the economy.
So the way ahead, some real warning clouds out there. And yet I think when people heard these numbers, they thought, my gosh, that's pretty good. Yes, there's a bounce back from Katrina. But take us into some of these numbers, Greg. For example, consumer durables up 20.6%. That's spending on, you tell us the kind of products that is. But these aren't small things. These are substantial purchases by American consumers.
Oh, sure. Those are big purchases. And normally when you see a big spending on durable goods, Tom, that definitely talks about confidence in the future. But a word of caution.
Is that automobiles?
Yes, it is. Automobiles are in there. And that, in fact, is where most of the growth was. Again, you had a depressed fourth quarter, partly because automakers had taken off some of the incentives that had propelled sales through the earlier part of 2005. Sales have bounced back in the first quarter, but they've settled in at a kind of a normal rate of an annualized 16 million cars per year. So I don't expect to see that kind of performance repeated.
Business spending up 14.3% investment at an annual rate. Does it mean that American business could take the baton from American consumers and somehow push this economy forward?
Yes, Tom. In fact, that is probably the most encouraging sign in all the economic numbers we've been talking about, because there's no temporary factor at work there. It really does seem that businesses have regained their animal spirits, as it were, after 3 or 4 years of extreme caution with respect to how much they want to expand. That's very good news. They're buying a lot of equipment, a lot of software. They're even starting to build new buildings and factories and office towers again after a very long period of stagnant investment in that area. And with business investment, you also get hiring. And so even if the economy is slow, we could probably still continue to see reasonably good gains in jobs.
What about wages, on the other hand? There was an expectation that they would be seen to be up. That I'm reading here, rank and file, hourly wages, that's 80% of the American workforce, have actually fallen. Well-paid workers continue to receive raises, but overall we're looking here at wage gains slowing in the first quarter. If the economy, if the numbers are so strong, why not wages strong as well?
It's probably the single biggest disappointment and somewhat of a mystery of this current economic expansion that amidst the strong GDP growth, the average wage earner is still doing so poorly. There are several reasons for that. Number one, gasoline prices tend to be eating into people's real disposable income. Number two, a lot of their labor income is being spent on benefits, things like health insurance, because health costs are going up so high. And workers are benefiting from that, but they do not see it in their paychecks. And number three, a lot of the economic growth has gone into profits. You've seen the tremendous profit numbers being reported by the likes of ExxonMobil and Goldman Sachs. So that's one reason you see strong GDP growth alongside sluggish wage growth. And finally, as you alluded to a second ago, it seems that it's the people at the top who are doing the best, the CEOs, the highly skilled professionals, and the average wage earner who's just not keeping up.
And finally, Greg, what about the new Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke? The Fed's been raising interest rates for a long time now under Alan Greenspan. Bernanke has kept that up so far. How does that look? How do interest rates play in here?
Tom, they're at a very delicate stage right now. They have been raising interest rates virtually nonstop since June 2004. And now they're at this stage now where they have the economy, they think, slowing to kind of a typical rate, more or less at full capacity, unemployment about as low as you can hope for it to go, inflation low but still a little bit on the high side of the range they're comfortable with, and interest rates more or less back to kind of normal levels. And so it's not obvious to them what they do next. And Bernanke has been trying to basically tell the markets and the public in the last few months, we're not sure what we're going to do next. Yes, we may pause on our interest rate increases, but that will be to sort of see what has the impact been of the last rate increases that we've had for the last year or two. If we continue to see moderate growth and low inflation, then maybe there won't be any more rate increases. But on the other hand, if the inflation numbers, which did tick up in the last month or two.
Up to what, Greg? Where were they?
We had the monthly rate of inflation was about 0.3%, excluding food and energy. It was around a little over 2%, including energy, the inflation numbers most of us care about. It's over 3%. But from the Fed's point of view, we seem to have had a little bit of an upward drift in some of these underlying measures of inflation, and they cannot let that get away from them. So if that trend does not reverse in the next month or two, they may have to continue with raising interest rates.
Greg Hipp, economics reporter at the Wall Street Journal, speaking with us from Washington. Greg, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being here.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
I'm joined right now from Philadelphia by Jeremy Siegel, professor of finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's author of the best-selling book, Stocks for the Long Run, a hugely influential book widely credited with helping spur the epic stock market enthusiasm of the 1990s. Jeremy Siegel, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Good to be here, Tom.
And with us from New Haven, Connecticut, is Robert Shiller, professor of economics at Yale University and author of the best-selling book, Irrational Exuberance, which strikingly foretold the epic stock market crash of 2000. Robert Shiller, wonderful to have you as well. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Jeremy Siegel, first to you. So we're getting the big number here. It looks great in the first quarter. Greg Gipp reminds us there's some bounce back from Hurricane Katrina here. We see all kinds of economists saying, careful, we're not sure how strong this is going forward. How do you gauge the health of the U.S. economy right now? How do you explain these high numbers in the teeth of high oil, soft real estate, wages down, and all the rest?
Right. It does seem puzzling. I think one of the important things is what Greg mentioned, and that is that we had a very strong first quarter. But looking forward, I think we're going to see the economy slow and go back down to probably a 3 to 3.5% rate. Also, we did have a very slow quarter in the fourth quarter of 2005. So I think The real excited consumer is going to calm down considerably as a result of the higher interest rates and the higher energy prices.
And those are upon us right now. Robert Shiller, you were gloomy at the end of the 90s as we came into 2000. Here we are in 2006. There's been a bounce back, pretty decent numbers over any number of quarters for GDP growth. What's your general attitude now toward the economy? How's it look?
Well, it looks very strong. But I think there are clouds on the horizon, and the biggest issue is the housing boom that we've seen, which is fading now, and the question is, where will that take us? And the second thing is the high oil prices. Both of these, I think, could derail this expansion.
But they haven't yet. We're looking at $70 plus a barrel oil, a place nobody thought we'd be quite this quickly, not very long ago, and still the numbers are there. How How much of that can the U.S. economy take and keep on rolling, Robert Shiller?
Well, I don't understand consumer psychology perfectly, but I think that there's such a thing as lags, that people respond for a while. People have seen this oil crisis now for a while, but I don't know if they really sunk in that this is here to stay. If you look at futures markets, they're predicting really high oil prices all the way out to 2012. And as this sinks in, I think it might change consumer attitudes. And if the real estate market starts falling, we may see a change in consumer attitudes.
Jeremy Siegel, on the oil front, what about the impact on American business? Consumers so far filling up the tank. Does business take a hit as oil goes up, or do they just pass the price along?
They swallow some of it, and I think that some of it is passed along. What has been amazing is that very little of the higher energy prices so far have seeped into what we call core inflation. Core inflation is what the Fed is looking at and trying to target.
That is the numbers without oil factored in.
Exactly, without actually oil and food, but oil is the very critical factor at this juncture.
Carl is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Thank you. I don't see any economic activity at all around here. We have a Delphi plant, which is scaling back.
Mm-hmm.
We had a steel industry, which is virtually gone. Our county has a control board. We're on the verge of a control board. The city of Buffalo is under a control board.
What does that mean, under a control board, Carl?
The city elected officials are not allowed to determine where the money is to be spent without having it approved by a board board that's appointed by the state of New York.
Because they're in such rough straits? None of that sounds great.
Nope. And New York State's finances are a joke. I expect them to be under some type of control board any time now also.
So you're looking around and saying, where's the boom?
Where is it? I haven't had a raise in 4 years, and I'm on my way to get gas right now. I passed two restaurants that are selling their equipment off, and one that's looking for a cook for $7 an hour, which seems to be grossly underpaid.
There's the Buffalo report. Carl, thanks for it. Let me put it to our guest, Jeremy Siegel, first to you. How do you respond to that?
I think the only thing good happening in Buffalo, it sounds like, is that they beat the Flyers in the hockey playoffs. I sympathize with what you're saying. There is no question that for manufacturing, it's been under pressure. Manufacturing has been under pressure in the U.S. for 25 years. We've lost half our jobs since 1970. The trend is actually worldwide, not just in the United States. And manufacturing wages are stagnant and down after you take into account inflation. I just think this is a worldwide trend that there is very little we can do anything about.
And there's a strong regional quality here, I guess, in this growth. Robert Shiller, what about the sense of a gap emerging here? We've seen wages flat or even down, yet GDP numbers up. I mean, there was a time, I think, when people assumed what was good for the GDP was good for America, really for all Americans. Is that still the case? Is there a gulch in the middle here somehow that's new?
Well, of course, a rising GDP is in principle good for everyone. It could be. But I think the big issue facing this country and other countries today is the risk that income inequality will continue to get worse. We're more capitalist than we were 20 or 30 years ago. And capitalism can redistribute things, you know, have great success for some people and some regions. So Buffalo may not be the strongest region. And Carl, who called, maybe he's not in the strongest occupation. But the problem with capitalism is it tends sometimes, if it's untrammeled, to lead to a winner-take-all society. And we seem to be moving in that direction. And that's the concern that we have going forward.
Jeremy Siegel, what about it? Is it possible that we move into a time where we see good numbers that traditionally would have meant good times, and yet they just don't feel like good times for lots and lots of people? I mean, look at these numbers. What, only 24% of Americans polled say the country's moving in the right direction. I think historically, with economic growth this strong, that's an aberration. Are we unhitching a traditional kind of formula or presumptions here?
Well, I definitely think we are. First of all, I think dissatisfaction with the administration's policy in Iraq is driving down overall moving in the right direction.
Sure.
Because I don't think in that we are moving in the right direction. Also, you know, the two big visibles are interest rates and gas prices. And, boy, they've been moving up, particularly the latter, dramatically. So, you know, even though unemployment is, you know, at a very low level, you know, we created 4 million jobs over the last 2 years, it just doesn't feel good. When you take all these other things into account, I think in terms of the average worker, unskilled or semi-skilled worker, what we've had over the last 10 years is 2 billion people in China and India have joined the world labor force, and you know, with wages that are, you know, much, much lower than the U.S. That's putting pressure on these unskilled wages everywhere in the developed world, in Europe, even in Japan, I've read, and also in the United States. Is it greater inequality? In some sense, yes, because what you need now is to skills to raise you above just totally unskilled workers, because that is what the rest of the world is supplying. And I think that as public policy, we have to think about the losers of globalization. I think overall it's a winning proposition, but I think it does lead towards a group that are not going to benefit, and we have to think about how we can help them.
Robert Shiller, give us a little economics 101 here on GDP growth. I mean, that number, it's an American number. It's not growing because on the back of output in China. It's on the basis of output and spending here in the United States. So if wages aren't doing well, but yet we're told consumers are a big part of what's driving or what drove the growth in the first quarter, what does that mean? Could it be that that small or that portion of Americans who are doing quite well, thank you, can they drive it alone? Is this, you know, sub-zero refrigerators and Bentleys and yachts driving that kind of growth?
Well, sub-zero refrigerators are part of it, I tell you. The consumers are... You know, consumer confidence is not at a particularly high level, but consumer spending is very high, and saving has been negative. It was negative last year for the whole year. And I think that it's complicated to analyze the psychology, but I keep coming back to the real estate boom, which may be softening, but it's still with us. And it has driven construction activity. The construction activity... Residential investment was 6.2% of GDP last year, the highest since 1950, and that was the baby boom year when construction right after World War II should have been high. When they build all these houses, people have to furnish them, so consumer durables are up. And lots of activity is associated with this. It's a lot. This is the real estate boom, and we're still in the effects of that boom.
But let me ask you, could it be the same question? Could it be that it's the affluent upper tier of the society that can they drive the whole GDP number? What if it's not? What if there's a huge chunk of the country like a Carl in Buffalo that hasn't had a raise in 4 years and isn't spending? Can an economy float on the activity of its top tier to this level?
Yeah, but it's not just the top tier. Mm-hmm. If it were, there are not that many of these people.
Yep.
When the stock market goes up or when the housing market goes up, that has a wealth effect. But the wealth effect is more down in the lower. The rich people don't necessarily spend a lot more when the stock market goes up. But we have a general consumption boom, and it's related to the people's perceptions that even though they may have worries about Iraq or oil prices, they just see home prices getting to such astronomical levels that they see little point in saving. They think they're being made rich by this boom.
Home as piggy bank. Let's take a call from Washington, D.C. Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. You know, I'm disappointed that your economists are not drilling down a little deeper into the true basis for a lot of this stimulus, and I think...
Give them time, Mark. We're going there. Where would you point us?
Well, I think you should be focusing on two things. The enabling that the Chinese have done through buying our treasury bonds and keeping our interest rates low, which is a bad thing, as well as the deficit spending, which is stimulating the economy, which is also a bad thing. So we're seeing some what appear to be positive effects, but ultimately are going to hurt us.
Is this then a kind of hall of mirrors economy? Let us look at it, Mark. Jeremy Siegel, what about it? Deficit spending and the Chinese kind of free lunch that's been rolled out to the U.S., does that make these numbers illusory?
We do have deficit spending. Actually, on the government side, it's as a percent of GDP, believe it or not, it's not as bad as what we see in Europe. It's about 3 to 3.5%. We want to keep it at below 3, so we're not too far out of line there.
But we don't really want to judge ourselves by Europe. I mean, eurosclerosis is not what we want here.
Right. Well, believe it or not, deficits even in Japan, in the developed world. But I think when we talk about our current account or our trade deficit, the tremendous purchase of U.S. government bonds by the Asian countries have helped keep our interest rates low. Now we begin to see them rising again. The imports subtract from GDP, so our big trade deficit, if we were to stop that, would actually give us at least a temporary boost, but it would mean, I think, a lot more inflation. I think one thing that's really important is that this first quarter is one quarter. It followed a very slow quarter in the fourth quarter of 2005, and I believe that consumer spending is going to go much lower as a result of interest rates and oil prices in the second, third, and fourth quarters. What I think is going to keep the economy going is capital spending by corporations. I think Greg mentioned that briefly in his review. We definitely, after many years of very sluggish spending by corporations, they've begun to increase their spending again. And that, I think, is able to offset the slack that we're going to see in the consumer side.
Robert Shiller, what about you? How do you see the sort of twin deficits here, fiscal and trade deficits, and the Chinese blank check underwriting American debt? Do you see these leaving us living in a kind of economy of illusion?
Well, I think that's a good term, because the real estate boom, I think, is illusion. That is, we live in the same houses. Now they're selling for twice as much in some cities as they were, you know, 6-7 years ago, but they're the same houses. We feel richer just because we value them higher. We don't seem to have any concern about the twin deficits. You know, Bush got reelected in spite of this. Public concern goes in waves. It's a matter of media attention and just right now we're concerned about immigration. There's a huge concern about that. But deficits is just kind of forgotten right now. And that's part of the reason why people are spending so. They feel they're not worried about it, not now, until something scares them.
China is often said these days to underwrite American borrowing because we're such a great market for them. Is there any indication that they might stop or change that policy, Robert Shiller?
Well, that's definitely true. The People's Bank of China is making noises of moving into other reserve currencies besides just the dollar. There's no reason for them to continue doing this forever. And I think that it's not something that we can count on going on forever.
Susan's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. Mr. Shiller just actually touched on the point that I called in with, which is, I believe, you know, to sort of dumb this whole situation down, I believe there is a hugely inflated middle class in this country because of the incentives that were given from the car industry in 2005, and because of the amount of people who are getting into homes with, you know, nothing down and, you know, getting into these homes but then not being able to afford the bills. We recently moved from a house to an apartment, and that was because we got into the house and we thought, what did we get ourselves into here? We're going to either, you know, continue to accrue more debt, even though it's apparently good debt, but we just had to stop the bleeding and say, you know what, we can't afford it right now. And I just think that Americans, like Mr. Shiller was saying, they just don't think about it, and we didn't think about it. When we went into the home, we thought, we'll figure it out. We got in the home, we thought, this is not the right thing to do, so we got out of it. Everybody just, you know, sort of seems to be buying things that they just cannot afford. And I believe that that is creating a false middle class in this country.
So you're not living large, but rather tightening up and looking at a kind of maybe a bubble out there. Susan, thanks for your call. Let's get another. Rochester, New York, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
I'm listening to this, and I'm just really amazed because I keep looking at this thing about a surging economy, and even though I live in Rochester, I have friends all over the country, and what I'm hearing from people is that folks are running harder just to stand in place. Things aren't good. So help me understand how it I'm just listening to the gentleman there,
mm-hmm.
and it sounds as though he's spinning it like it's all great, it's all wonderful.
Well, I'm not quite hearing that, but the numbers themselves are certainly high after a Katrina downturn. And you're saying, you're not feeling it, and your buddies around the country don't feel it.
No, and as a matter of fact, I was down in the Katrina zone doing some relief work. It's horrible down there, and yeah, they're spending like it's nobody's business, but they're literally coming up out of the ground. So help me understand this, because these numbers don't seem to make sense. I look at the stock ticker, and this thing is going through the roof, and I'm looking and I'm seeing these big houses being built out in the suburbs, and the folks that I'm talking to, everybody's saying the same thing. Who's buying these places? Who can afford this stuff?
Mike, we've got it. And Jeremy Siegel, the same question comes back. I guess let's take another swing at it. You hear the kind of the public impression there, or at least Mike's in Rochester, and how do you respond?
Well, we should remember a very important variable. The unemployment rate is very low, 4.6%. There are jobs. Jobs are being created, say, 4 million jobs over the last 2 years after quite a few years of sluggish growth. And inflation outside the oil sector is low. I know oil is very, very visible. Mm. I would like to say, and I agree with Bob, and I agree with the callers, I think the real estate boom is over. And these rising interest rates are really going to cause a downturn in real estate. And I think that's going to affect consumer spending. And if it weren't for the pickup, what I think is in business spending, we might have a substantial slowdown. But I'm optimistic that business spending and maybe even a little bit of export growth might actually keep the economy, if not cooking, certainly 5%, I don't think is going to happen the rest of the year, but maybe at 3.5%, which it's still moderate and decent growth.
I want to look at oil for a moment, if we can. Jeremy Siegel, when your output at the Wharton School looked ahead to the U.S. economy in 2006, you said that the economy and consumers will stay resilient as long as oil prices do not rise above, say, $70 a barrel, which you did not anticipate. Now here we are. Is that enough alone to put a spike in this thing?
Right. That it surprised me. It's of course hit 75 and is hovering near that area. It's going to take a bite, Tom. There's no question. I mean, again, the fourth quarter was a result of Katrina and the spike that we took in the third quarter, and we slowed down dramatically. Then we bounced back in the first quarter. Oil and gas was down, and at the very end of the quarter and into April, we've had another spike. So I think, yes, it's going to have effect. But I think one thing is very important. Back in the 1970s, the last oil so-called crisis, we went from 35 cents a gallon to a dollar. Mm-hmm. That was a tripling of prices. Gasoline a year ago was around $2.20. Now it's $3, a little bit above $3. It's almost the same dollar, but the difference is that it's not a tripling. It's not even a doubling. And the dollar certainly doesn't buy what it did back then. In real terms, it's only about a 50-cent increase. Mm. So, you know, people say, why isn't it hitting the economy the way it did in the 70s? And that is, even though it's very visible, it hasn't been anywhere near as severe in those percentage terms. And as we all know, the Europeans coming to the U.S. think that oil is and gasoline is so amazingly cheap because we just don't tax it a lot.
Runs
so
like water compared to their $6 and $7 a gallon gasoline.
Yeah, absolutely. We really have to think about, what kind of energy policies we need and conservation policies we need. This is very important. I think a lot of the dissatisfaction is that we don't see this administration or Congress really doing anything sensible. I mean, $100 rebate that floated by the Republicans and
kind of a joke.
No one liked it. And it just, we don't seem to have good policies and ideas that are coming out. We all recognize that something has to be done with the huge oil imports and conservation and moving towards alternative fuels. This is a very, very important area.
Robert Shiller, then here we are. We've got these great numbers. Part of it's just bounced back from Katrina. A bunch of it's not being felt as widely as it might because wages aren't going up. And each of you, Jeremy Siegel and yourself, Professor Shiller, are painting real significant potential problems out in front of us. If you were king of the mountain, if you were the big boss, what kind of major public policy steps would you suggest if public policy can can set the groundwork for widespread, healthy, long-term economic growth here, from energy and right on across the board. What do you wish the U.S. was doing in terms of public policy?
Well, I have a number of policy ideas in my recent book, New Financial Order, and I've developed one recently with Len Berman and Jeff Rohalli at the Urban Institute. We should be really concerned about rising inequality. It has been steadily growing in this country for decades, and it shows no sign of stopping. Our proposal is that we should, this may sound a little technical, but we should change the tax system so that it is indexed for inequality, so that it automatically offsets any future increases in inequality.
That's how would that work, Professor Schiller? What do you mean exactly by that?
Well, right now the tax system is indexed to the consumer price index, but that's not that's a good thing. But we can index it further. We can devise it that the tax rates automatically become more progressive if inequality gets worse. We're not trying to. This isn't Robin Hood. This isn't trying to take from the rich and give to the poor. It's just stopping it, saying we've got an unequal enough society now. Let's stop it where it is.
But what's the difference between indexing and just having higher progressive taxation, which we've moved markedly away from in the last few decades? I mean, isn't that are you suggesting we'd go back to where high-income earners paid 60, 70, 80% income tax?
I don't think that's necessary for the foreseeable future. The point is that Congress has great difficulty legislating these changes, but they could legislate more easily an indexation formula. And if they did that, it would be much easier for them to adopt pro-growth policies, because right now everything, any policy, people start thinking, well, what is it going to do for the rich versus the poor?
Mm-hmm.
So let's just stop it. Let's just say it's going to stay where it is. This isn't, you know, radical in any way. It's let's stop the trend toward increasing inequality. This is the most important issue that we have today.
Let me ask you another question about that. Since we already have quite significant inequality at the moment, a run-up in inequality, if you were going to address it in this way, how would you change top marginal tax rates right now? Would it suggest an immediate increase or not?
Well, see, I think that's water over the dam. It's politically difficult. Once people start earning more money mm-hmm. and they build their mansion, that was the deal.
Locked
they
in.
Got it.
Yep.
And it's hard to roll that back. I'm just saying, you know, it could get a lot worse. This isn't over. The trend is showing that inequality is getting worse and worse. I'm just trying to say, let's look at this and see what's happening. And there are lots of people being left behind. Let's stop it.
Speak to the economic implications of that inequality. I mean, it doesn't feel good if you're not on the fat side of the equation. Over time, one would think it leads to political instability. But just as an economist, what are the economic ramifications of a society more and more unequal in its distribution of wealth and income?
Well, I think one great strength of the United States is that people sense that this is the land of opportunity. They don't feel locked into some low wage forever. If you get to a situation where people think that it's hopeless, then it creates a lot of negative things for our society. We won't have a stable society. We won't have the low crime rates. We won't have just the general support for pro-growth policies. So the United States has had a progressive tax for decades now. People have accepted that. It's part of the price of civilization. And, you know, rich people should vote for this too. Because, you know, you don't have to be fabulously rich. You want to be happy, right?
Right.
You don't want an unhappy population. You want Americans to feel that we all participate in this economy.
You don't want to be rich behind
gaining.
Barbed wire.
We want to all be gaining from the growth in the economy.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy Siegel, how about it? You're the exuberance guy. progressive taxation, index it. If inequality gets worse, raise those high-end income taxes. Would you vote for that as an economist or not?
It depends on how it's structured. I mean, I worry about incentives. I worry about, you know, someone, say, studies hard for training on a new job where they're going to get higher income, and we're going to say we're going to put higher taxes on you. And, you know, we have to be very, very careful about any sort of progressive tax system, not destroying the incentives to improve, to do better. As Bob correctly said, land of opportunity, which means I have the opportunity to better myself and get a higher income.
Yep.
But on the other side, I understand what Bob is saying, and I think globalization, it echoes some of the words I said earlier. I think it is if it's structured right, it could be a gain for everybody. And Bob calls them pro-growth policies, I think pro-globalization, but they are stopped by people saying, well, look at these people are going to be hurt. If we can figure out a way to distribute some of the gains from globalization back to the people that we feel might be hurt, I think there's enough gain there to do that and for them then to say, yes, this is good for our entire society. If we could go in that direction, I think there might be gains for everybody.
So to keep the country on what you see as the winning path long term, maybe some tinkering along the way. Elwood's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Elwood. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hey, how are you doing today?
We're great. What do you think, Elwood? What do you hear?
I hear, for example, that the 4 million people that we have that are recently employed are all in the low-wage service industry situation. And furthermore...
Well, surely not everybody.
Well, probably a large percentage, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, on top of that, we have 46 million people who aren't getting any health insurance. I think we have some major problems, and people aren't taking a look at what's really happening to a large percentage of our people. The middle class, I think, is also pretty much being sort of wiped out in this whole situation, and I don't know what they're going to do. Somebody solve that for me?
So how would you feel about reaching into some higher income tax rates for those who are doing very well in the globalized economy? Does that sound like a good idea to you, or does it sound like it might kill the goose, Elwood?
No, I think it's a great idea. I think those people need to have their rates increased a lot. Matter of fact, as the United States, you need to help pay for some of the people who can't.
There's the voice from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Robert Shiller, do you see it happening politically? I know you're an economist, but, you know, the country's leaned the other way for a long time now, ever since Ronald Reagan, for sure.
Well, I tend to be an idealist and think about the long-run future, but I think there is a potential for adopting some kind of indexation of the tax system to make it more progressive in response to inequality, because that will allow Congress, just as Jeremy said, to take on pro-growth policies, which they want to do. And so I think that it's especially easy for Congress to vote in some kind of indexation system that doesn't raise taxes now, that raises them only if the problem appears.
Or appears worse. Let me ask each of you about your sort of most famous position. Given where we stand right now, Jeremy Siegel, you're the stocks for the long run guy. Right. On the course we're on, are you optimistic about the economy and, for that matter, the stock market?
I'm optimistic about the stock market. We've had quite an amazing recovery, and the Dow Jones, as was mentioned, actually also standing poor in six-year highs. I think we could have another 5-10% gain in stock prices over the next, say, 8 to 12 months. My feeling is earnings are doing extremely well. I think the concern is interest rates. That's the major concern, and that's why there's so much discussion, as you asked Greg Ip, about when Ben Bernanke is going to stop raising rates. If the market thinks that the Fed is nearly done, I think it has some good upside potential. Mm-hmm. Actually, compared to real estate, and I would say maybe I would even get my good friend Bob to agree with this, I think stocks look better in the long run right now. International stocks, all stocks, classes diversified than the real estate market, most certainly.
Bob Shiller, we just got half a minute. Let me turn to you. You're Mr. Irrational Exuberance. Are we irrationally exuberant at the moment, or how do you see the market?
I'm not as optimistic as Jeremy, but I agree that given the situation in real estate, a direct investment in real estate might not be preferable to the stock market, especially if you do it internationally and spread it out around the world. So, I think that the big threat, though, to the stock market is the high oil prices, the rising interest rates, and the possible decline in real estate price. So I don't think it's a safe place to be either.
a lot of pieces in motion here, and you've given us a lot of help in understanding them. We're very grateful to you. Robert Shiller, professor of economics at Yale. Professor Shiller, thank you so much for joining us today.
Tom, a pleasure to be here.
And Jeremy Siegel at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Siegel, always wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
In a moment, Tom Brokaw encourages the class of 2006 to be the next greatest generation. This is On Point. It's graduation season again. In the coming weeks, we'll be bringing you highlights from commencement speeches around the country. Today, we take you to Tallahassee. The Florida State University class of 2006 got their degrees last weekend. Former NBC News anchorman Tom Brokaw gave the commencement address. In his speech, he encouraged the new graduates to aspire to the greatness of their grandparents' generation.
On this campus, through this World War II Institute, you safeguard the memories of another generation of Americans, the greatest generation, the young men and women who came of age in the Great Depression when this country was on the brink of calamitous economic and political collapse. They grew up with the ethos of sacrifice and common purpose. And just when that dark time in America was beginning to ebb, this country was attacked at Pearl Harbor and Germany declared war. And this generation was asked to give still more sacrifices. Their president asked them to go thousands of miles across the Atlantic and thousands of miles across the Pacific to fight in the greatest war in the history of mankind. At home, those left behind turned the country into a military assembly line, turning out new tanks, planes, and weapons at an unprecedented pace. Every day, every American family worried about their loved ones in harm's way and the loved ones of their neighbors. When the war was over, these same young men and women, your age, who had known only hardship and sacrifice, came home to go to college in record numbers, get married in record numbers, and to build the country that we have today. They expanded the rights of minorities and women left behind too long. They gave us those new industries and new science and new art. They produced a distinctive and gifted generation called the baby boomers. Those are your parents, and you are the beneficiaries of all that they did. You've not had to survive a Great Depression. When war came to your generation, you could decide whether to go or to stay home. Most of you will leave this campus with more earthly possessions than your grandparents had after 20 years of hard work. But you have this in common: the privilege of American citizenship, the legacy of exercising it every day for the common welfare of those here at home and those beyond our shores who still look to this country every day as a powerful statement of what should be possible for all. Leave this campus and show the world how to hate hate. Leave this campus and love your mother, Mother Earth. Become colorblind and define greatness for your generation. Thank you all very much.
Former NBC News anchorman Tom Brokaw delivering the commencement speech Saturday at Florida State University. About 5,000 graduate and undergraduate diplomas were issued this year, the largest graduating class in FSU's history. Congratulations to them all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.